Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about platypus. I'm reading a book, a very beautiful book by Anne Morrell, a independent scholar in Australia. She's now 92, living in Canberra, and she's done a very thorough job stitching together many layers of meaning into the analysis of this small furry animal, the size of a platypus. It looks like a big rat, I suppose, to think, or identified as a large mole. It's about 34 centimeters long, so it's longer than your A4 page, but not much longer. And what I'm going to do is just review some of the ideas associated with it. So we have to start off with the extinction of the dinosaurs by a large asteroid, which we believe landed in the Gulf of Mexico and heated up some sulfate rock, spewing sulfuric acid and sulfates into the atmosphere. And this dramatically cooled the planet, and everything also caught fire at the same time. And this and other pressures pushed dinosaurs off the edge. And they're replaced for a short time by giant birds. And all the time this is happening, there's a theory by Alfred Wegener, continental drift, that the actual continents are moving forming together and breaking apart. Now that's the theory of the description, but the actual mechanism behind it is something called plate tectonics, that the Earth's outer layer, crust, hard crust, sits on top of a plasticine-like interior called the mantle, which is sticky as toothpaste, and deep within that is a liquid core and a solid core. So it's solid all the way down. We see a molten lava come up through geysers or through volcanoes and things like that, but it's a sort of an aberration. It's a chemical mix of fluxes, heat and flux move together, and you have particularly low melting point rock moving about. It's also got the disadvantage of being thermally conductive, a good thermal conduction mechanism there, and so that heat from the interior is sufficient at the lower pressures to turn it into a liquid. It gushes out, so people get the impression that the Earth just underneath the crust is liquid, but it's actually not solid. I'm just going back over the theories there. So there are many plates. So you can imagine like an eggshell above the crust, and the crust is called the lithosphere or the rock sphere. So the sort of definition of rock is the sort of thing that you can hold. It's nice and solid. It doesn't deform with time, and it's got distinct crystals. So in the mantle is more like a cake mix. It doesn't have crystals in it because it's too hot, too high pressure. Well, it does sort of have microcrystals, and in fact, the rocks straight out of the mantles have these very small crystals. The rock, which oozes, I suppose, from the mantle, but more from the asthenosphere, is the sea floor, and that's a basalt. And when you look at it, it's got very, very tiny, tiny crystals. And those crystals aren't really well defined. It's more like, as I say before, a cake mix. Now, this is all getting on to what's happening with our poor little platypus and echidna coming on. And these layers, as we used to think, there was upthrusts in the mantle causing convection currents, and this would shuffle along these plates. But it looks as though the plates are just sinking naturally underneath where they sink, and as they sink, they drag across, and this dragging thing pulls apart things. So I think the Pacific Ocean was expanding, the Atlantic is expanding, so it's like a weeping saw, a pussy saw, a scab. You keep on pulling on either side, it keeps on oozing up on that side. So Australia and South America were together, joined together on Antarctica in Gondwana land. Now I've forgotten the origin of the word Gondwana land. I have to go back and reread it. It's gone from my head. Where it's from, Gondwana land. Really trying to think. The names are disappearing. This is sort of just an aside. I'm doing this just to reboot my brain, my memory, after I suppose a brain trauma, a bit of a shake-up of that old head, trying to get things back together. I don't know whether they're ever going to actually ever get back together as they used to be. So I can't recall all of these facts, so I have to forgive me. Around 300 million years ago, so this is when the very early reptiles, a bit before the rise of the dinosaurs, out where I'm living, was the roof of the world much taller than Mount Everest. There weren't too many trees. There was about to be huge forests about to spring up. So life on Earth, multicellular 600 million years ago, complex life in the seas 500 million years ago, things began to get out of the seas. 325 million years ago, 300 million years ago, things started going. You've got a fair amount of time happening here, and what happened is that Australia has been butted up against Antarctica. It was hard to think that it's really one continent being pushed together from the outside, very high up, forming our area. I'm not going to go down the route of path explaining the geology of our area. The continents began to separate or move upwards. And so we've been moving up for the past 80 million years. I don't know when we formally separated from Gondwana land. But you have to remember that this time, all these areas were temperate. We're in an unusually cold spell at the moment. And so the polar regions were temperate. And a few other things, like we weren't at 23 degrees, where our Earth was rocked at a slightly different time. The moon was close, the days were slightly shorter, we began to drift north, as well as South America drifting north. And Australia was very isolated, but some of our species, early species of marsupials were also found. There are some marsupials, not many, found in South America. In South America, the marsupials had to compete with the mammals, or not with the mammals, placentals. So let's break it up. Marsupials are all animals which have fur, and they produce milk. And we didn't necessarily know that there. They've got other characteristics together. So a placental animal has a womb, placenta, and gives birth to live young. Now, we all begin off as eggs. We all have an eggshell. Eggshell develops as we go down the fallopian tube. Around day 14 from the emission from the... is it day 14 or 7? I really can't remember. And I'll have to reboot my memory there. Your eggshell breaks and you hatch. And a few cells bury itself into the placenta. Now, this is not necessarily an evolutionary step from marsupials. So everything, I suppose, was monotremes, and from the monotremes split off marsupials. It's sort of hard to say. And from the marsupials developed placentals. Now, it wasn't a slow evolutionary step to make that step. And the evidence comes from archaic viruses found. So viruses used to go from the mother to the fetus. So it was a key way that viruses could replicate. So rather living out in the real world, they would go between the two. And part of that is deforming and forming blood supplies. So there's a whole series of steps to make the uterus, the placenta, and that style of stuff is not necessarily thought to be evolution. This may be a bit of a shock to everyone, but there is a line of theory which I think has got good genetic evidence that this was viruses and things taking over the top and sort of steering us down one path. Now, of course, evolution, when that change came about, so evolution doesn't really care where the change comes from. It just says, is that change just good? It comes across. So there wasn't a series of freak mutations which led up to a placenta. There was more a trip turnaround of virus attacks which led the eggs to implant inside the mother and begin to grow over a long period of time, but not necessarily a very long period of time. We know that marsupials mammals existed way into the dinosaur era, so we've got examples of it. So it's exactly what was happening, how they originated, it's how they lived and how they reproduced I suppose uncertain back to those days. We're getting a reasonably complete kit of dinosaurs and stuff like that. I suppose one of the things where you get complete capture of dinosaurs is where they're beginning to see fossilization by misadventure, and this is when they see a behavioral aspect of fossilization. So a behavioral aspect of fossilization is if you say the males and females behave differently and you get more males, if you have, and I have more males in my fossil record, therefore fossilization favored males doing sort of eccentric sort of stunts and various things. Although this is the entire life of birth aspect of it. So whether monotremes are more ancient than marsupials, it's hard to know. But this is one of the things I want to say in review. So monotremes, as it's seen, so monotremes are the platypus and the echidna, which is a platypus. I really still can't pronounce the Latin name for platypus and echidna. These are both egg-laying mammals. They don't have placentas, they're not marsupials, they don't have pouches. They lay the egg out, and as you read this book, you get some more information. So this is a soft egg. Still, it's got an eggshell. I don't know whether it's got a tooth to break its shell. And both the echidna and the monotreme lay eggs. It's really interesting to see that the Europeans, when they came into Australia, just left a volley. You know, as soon as they saw a platypus, they just shot it. They shot hundreds of them. Just kept on blatting away with them. It's sort of like, you can imagine, millions of years of evolution, and all of a sudden these creatures come up and start attacking you. And So the platypus and the echidna. So the echidna is a really cute sort of animal. It's a sort of like a monster-sized hedgehog, but it's got differences from a normal hedgehog. Firstly, its back, walks on its knuckles with its toes pointing backwards, its back feet. It's something which I've only observed recently. And it's also got what you really wouldn't recognise as a. It's also got a beak. It's a beaked hedgehog with a long beak. So the beak is, say, a fifth length of its body sticking out. This black little beak, circular beak. And it's not the beak like a duck, it's a beak like a woodpecker. Something similar to that. And it pokes its beak into ants' nests and down holes and stuff like that. Which is an important thing to say. So we've got two aspects. Both the platypus and the echidna have beaks, and they both lay eggs. Now, one of the things, we'll put those two together, on the other side, their fur is related, so the platypus's, sorry, the echidna's, a bit unlike a hedgehog, its spines are actually matted fur poking out. And I was surprised to read in this book that the platypus also has a splattering of two different types of fur, so they've had a common ancestor. And I suppose I should have to go back, is that in the fossil records there have been monster platypuses. And again, that would have had a major effect on Darwin had he known that there were monster platypuses, because what happened there? Did the platypus shrink in size, or there are various things? And I would say that the larger, they would have speciated, and the larger ones would have not fared as well as the smaller ones going forward. So you've got these features of them. There's many shared features between platypuses and echidna. And echidna are these anteaters, these cute little animals. They're fairly timid. They make heaps and heaps of noise, particularly at night. You just think there's an army of people going around the place as they poke around. They're quite little active things, but they're not fast. They don't run very fast. And if you threaten them, they either go up into a ball or they just dig down into the soil and almost disappear into the ground. But they dig vertically down because they're almost like they've got almost two front ends. The front end with the beak, those claws, and the other claws go the other way, and it just burrows downwards. That's the echidna. So let's put this together. And as I've mentioned, the fur has got this dual fur, and it's also a dual fur in the echidna, with spikes and the fur in between the spikes of it. So we come across this thing, and it's really interesting that the Europeans were obsessed with does it have breasts, it's got to have nipples, it can't produce milk. And now this, which of course we now know that they do produce milk. And the theory, they had this theory that everything's evolved, it's less advantageous, it's sort of missed the boat, it hasn't been as smart as the other European animals. And what I'm going to do in this review is just offer a slightly different aspect to it. There's this French person, just reading this book, this French person in Tasmania, French national, for the French, Musée of Paris, museum in Paris, the Natural History Museum, which I'd absolutely love to see. He went to Tasmania, and rather than shoot the bastards, he observed them, and he observed some rather interesting things. He observed them mating, which is an unusual thing, and after they mated 4 or 5 minutes, etc., explained, you have to listen to the podcast to hear more about it, they played for several hours. And this is interesting, that platypuses do play. The little babies play with the mothers, and this is sort of a strange thing. It's an ancient creature playing very much like kittens and puppy dogs, things which play. It sort of says it's sort of a strange thing to you, and they're a strange animal. The way that they want to escape, the way that they're quite frisky and quite frightened, and just on the fear aspect of them, why they're so hard to see is that they are almost continuously underwater, because they have an underwater burrow entrance. Their burrow doesn't go out into the open and into the water. They don't have to get it that way. Their burrow is underneath the water. So they can be in the water and out of the water, and they live their entire time in the water. Of course, they can walk across land. And this French person also observed them, feeding, and, in the burrow, deep in the burrow, they've got a labyrinth, sometimes 16-meter burrow. So this is a substantial distance deep into the ground. And labyrinth, it turns and angles and moves, makes it very difficult for any predator to get in. They just get lost in their burrow system of false starts and things like that. But we see inside the burrow that they do... the mother does produce milk, and it just oozes out, and the little platypuses don't have fully developed beaks. They do have beaks, but this is a beaked mammal. Okay, they do have beaks, but they eat their And I suppose I haven't seen too much. That's David Attenborough. So the British have come out and done a good documentary on them. But this French person observed the little babies playing with the mother, and what would happen is that they would start scratching the mother's stomach, and the mother would produce the milk, and the milk would go into the water, and then they would drink it from the water. Now, the view is that this is very cumbersome, but on the other side, these beaks are incredibly sensitive. They're arrayed with electromagnetic touch and taste sensors. They're incredibly, incredible things, these beaks, and they're flexible, and they can delve and touch in the mud, and they can feel, and they just hoover up every worm or invertebrate, which is our little crayfishes out here, and they just hoover them up. And when I say hoover, is the Australian term for vacuum, just vacuum them up. Similarly, so their beak is a huge advantage to them. It's their threat, so to speak. Their big major advantage. Also, in echidna, their beak also would be an obstacle to breastfeeding on a nipple, because it's a little beak, but it could hoover up the or drink up the milk that just been chucked out in an area. And one of the things, going back to the platypus and this French person observing it, and again, look, my memory fails me on these critical parts. They're very efficient. No milk goes to waste, as you would possibly expect. And I think the French, coming back when they said, "Oh, they do produce something from their breasts," the French person said, I think it was Buffon, which she called a buffoon. Yeah, buffoon. I don't know whether that's the same story or the same origin of the word. Here, a buffoon, sort of a silly person. But he said, if it produces milk, let them bring me cheese. So this is ever, if you have a series of conclusions which you're not too happy with, you raise the standard of proof in that area that you don't like, and I have a lower standard of proof in the area that you do like. And this is probably a sign which we nowadays is rate as amateur or this non-professional scientist, and this is to be understood that the term scientist was invented in 1836, and the actual concept of what a scientist was, as opposed to a learned gentleman or a natural philosopher, only evolved over this time, so that they're not expected to be the highest level. But then again, you see this grade of reasoning used all the time. The thing is that rather than being an evolutionary oddity, these are things which had a strong suit, which is their beaks, and their beaks meant they couldn't suckle, and therefore, it would be no use for them being in a pouch with a teat there. It wouldn't help them any use. So in terms of evolutionary stuff, it pushes them off along those lines with the advantage of the beak. And this is true if you use, I'll just explain about computing a bit later on. Then again, placenta versus marsupial, it's an evolutionary thing, but it may also be the freak interplay of these viruses. Don't blame me. It's a theory out there, and it seems to me to be the strongest theory. Now let's have a review. Evolution. Evolution now is just drop-down menu. You, in terms of your optimization strategy. So as a scientist, I've had these problems. You come up against a problem, and eventually you go through it fairly quickly, and there's some maths to tell you whether it's an analytical solution, chaotic solution. So there's a certain number of solutions which have algebraic solutions. There's some things which don't have solutions, things which aren't functions or don't follow a functional form, can't be solved. They can be solved by guesstimation, but they can't be solved. by turning the handle on a computer to get a machine, you have to run many extreme versions nowadays. We call it artificial intelligence. I'm not going to say this is anywhere near artificial intelligence, but you have a series of natural analogues of solving strategies. One is called simulated annealing. I've written a few papers on simulated annealing. And this is where gradually crystallize and cool a solution. So you have your solutions go a certain way and they evolve and they feel from a certain area, and at a certain time you heat them up and you introduce errors and get them to tunnel down. You get them to do thousands and thousands of trials and you see which trial is the best, and you finally get up the best solution. Use that. And you can also use evolution, where the solutions are built into a sort of DNA and they're put in separate little islands to compete against each other. And the solutions evolve, and then you can move solutions from islands. This is all true to go across. And what actually happens is that one good solution can inhibit the development of other solutions in other areas. But if you just solve it with the best solution all up, you don't let a poorer solution, which could have evolved with better ways, to go forward. And so there is a sort of, you get an insight into evolution from using evolutionary optimization in computers to see an insight into the fact that the platypus has got a good solution and a very excellent solution for itself. It's absolutely thriving out here. And look, there are all these unusual things going on. This is unusual bird which has just flown over my head. It's a brilliantly camouflaged bird. It's a bower bird. I think it would be a female bower of the bower bird. So that's just an example of them hunting up a particular solution. So a lot of the solutions that you see are the result of selecting certain aspects for it, and similarly in your computing evolutionary stuff, Australia's a different area, and they've gone down this line of the beak, and the beak has provided excellent feeding apparatus, excellent. It's fine-tuned for the environment, but then it's it means it's, this solution has other problems which are solved up, which meant that, the pouch thing necessarily, if it ever was a thing, wouldn't be there, but also, the sort of mental assumption of survival of the fittest and things like that. So Darwin has an explanation for why a mutation will be taken in, but he doesn't necessarily have calls it natural variation. Well, there's unnatural variation due to inbreeding, as the species almost collapses. You get mutations due to poor genomic culture. You also have radiation, and you also have the impact of viruses and other things coming across. It's a very complex thing to go forward. This is a review at this stage, saying that my rereading of it is that, it's got a beak, therefore, because these are beaked mammals, they can't go down the placental route is denied to them, but the placental route is not something naturally that they would all co-evolve. And at what stage does the placental come out? It seems to be this implantation thing is not necessarily just purely environmental factors causing the variation for it. I suppose I'll have another review halfway through about just the general theory of Anne Morrell, which is looking at a conceptual hyperstructure to it. So when you actually look at it, there are these, I'll do this in the next episode, these conceptual hyperstructures that, what I call hyperstructures, the Europeans, when they saw the marsupial, their concern was with the hyperstructure that they were developing, which is a religious hyperstructure. Then Darwin came in with another one, of natural selection and a bit more science, and Morrell is coming with a sort of a meta hyperstructure. This is looking at the different structures, and I myself are looking at, you know, how this is a book. It's if you actually look back, people always read books and they read them in extreme detail. This is not happening nowadays, and we really need. And there are these hyperstructures in here, but the unexperienced reader, I'm not saying anyone's less experienced, won't see the hyperstructure. Yeah, they won't understand what I'm talking about in terms of hyperstructure. So I'll get back and try and talk about that in next episode. The next couple of episodes, next episode is episode 8, where I continue reading through, just over 2/3 of the way through the book, and we're going to read some really interesting modern times. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.